At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You spend your life savings on a house. It's tough to admit it's not worth what you thought it was. But sellers letting go of those expectations might be the best thing that ever happened. Today on the broadcast, when less for your house can actually be more. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. ProduceMoreConserveMore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday today, the 8th of October, and it is good to have you with us. Well, I'll tell you, it is a veritable smorgasbord of economic delights out there today. We will begin with you, the humble American consumer. Retail sales reports from last month came in this morning a bit better than anybody had been guessing. I saw one analyst quoted as saying, consumers are starting to dip their toes back in, but only their toes. Mortgage rates are down. Freddie Mac reported the rate on traditional 30-year fixed loans stayed below 5% for the second week in a row. Mortgage applications, especially for refinancings, are up. And a report out from the real estate company Trulia today says something else is happening, too. Sellers are dropping their prices. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains why.
Claude Sigmund put his two-bedroom house on the market in St. Paul just over a year ago. He listed it at $145,000. He thought it was worth more, but the realtor convinced him.
I had a grand total of 54 showings in my house before it finally sold, and I was selling it for $100,000. They offered $90,000, and I pay closing costs, and that was the best deal I had received.
A lot of homeowners are finding themselves in a similar position. Trulia is a real estate listing company and says about a quarter of all people currently trying to sell homes have cut their prices at least once. That data doesn't include foreclosure sales. Chris Mayer tracks real estate at Columbia's Business School, and he says reality is finally sinking in for home sellers.
There's an initial loss, and people are looking at this and saying, but God, I paid $400,000 for the house. I'm just not going to sell it at $300,000. And over time, people realize that that $400,000 isn't coming back, and they adjust their expectations.
Of course, the economy's still rocky, and people are still losing jobs, so some homeowners are just plain desperate. Heather Fernandez works at Trulia, and she says more and more people are getting notices of default, the last warning before foreclosure.
A trend that we're seeing is an increasing level of notice of default across the country, which lead us to believe that sellers are going to have to sell.
She says all this can mean good news for buyers, who, if they have cash, can get some very good deals. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Before any of us had ever heard the word subprime, insurance companies were some of the biggest buyers of mortgage bonds out there. Those, of course, are bonds now known by another name, toxic assets. Ratings agencies, the ones like Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's, used to help sort the good stuff from the bad in the bond world. Their reputations aren't so good now, though, so regulators are looking to some sophisticated bond investors, companies like BlackRock and PIMCO, for help. From New York, Jill Barchet explains.
The rating agencies are shooting down mortgage-backed bonds with downgrade after downgrade. Marilyn Cohen is the president of Envision Capital Management, which invests in bonds. She says everyone in the insurance business thinks the rating agencies are going over the top.
I think the regulators want some different layer of input And who do you go to? You go to the big guys who have put, you know, their customers' money on the line on these same types of securities and not only survived but thrived.
But Cohen points out there is a conflict of interest here.
The BlackRocks and the PIMCOs of this world own similar or exactly the same securities that the insurance companies hold.
But she says their models and methods are much more sophisticated than the rating agencies, and they'd probably do a better job. Bernie Birnbaum is the executive director of the Center for Economic Justice, a consumer advocacy group. He says insurance regulators are being too sympathetic to the companies they oversee. If these private ratings are gentler, insurers won't have to keep as much money on their books.
Consumers should be concerned that insurance companies don't have the same resources to fulfill their promises as they did a year ago.
Next week, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners will consider the merits of using big fund managers to rate mortgage bonds. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
The lights and the cameras might be here in Los Angeles, but increasingly the action is elsewhere. Foreign countries and other U.S. cities and states have been luring filmmakers away with tax breaks and other incentives for years. Now Los Angeles is mad as heck, and it's not going to take it anymore, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
The L.A. City Council wants to offer tax incentives, make it easier to book locations, and offer free parking, the L.A. Holy Grail, to film crews. Jason Squire is with the USC Film School. He says these incentives are long overdue.
For years, the city of Los Angeles has not been implementing this, believing, because it is the center of entertainment, that it wasn't necessary and it wasn't really a serious enough issue.
The number of films shot in California has dropped dramatically since 2003, costing the city jobs and revenue. During that time, more than 40 states were offering tax breaks and other perks to lure filmmakers. But as California is stepping up its incentives, a lot of those states have started scaling back.
For most of these states, it's really a waste of money. It actually ends up costing the taxpayers a lot more than they think.
Entertainment industry analyst Hal Vogel says states thought the tax breaks would pay off in jobs and extra revenue, but the investment in infrastructure outweighed the money the films brought in. Michigan, for instance, spent more than $30 million last year in tax incentives to film companies. Now the state is looking at a big budget shortfall and needs all the tax dollars it can get.
I mean, there's a reason why L.A. didn't start making cars, because the expertise to make cars is in Detroit. But that's not the expertise of necessarily Detroit making movies.
Vogel says incentives do make sense in places like Los Angeles and New York, which have the infrastructure already in place. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
It will be the happy music when we get there. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've got a standing request in to talk to Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. He's a tough guy to get on the line, as you might imagine. But a story out today from the Associated Press does shed some light on his telephone habits. The AP got its hands on the first 7 months' worth of the secretary's appointment calendars. They show a whole lot of time, 80 conversations over those 7 months, spent on the phone with executives from three big Wall Street banks, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs. For some insight into who Mr. Geithner ought to be talking to, if not Wall Street, we've called Anil Kashyap at the University of Chicago. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Two ways to look at this story, I suppose. One, and I wanted to run both of them by you. The first is, isn't this who we want the Treasury Secretary to be talking to, the people who run the big banks in New York City, and what's the big deal?
What's the alternative? He isn't talking to them, and he's trying to rewrite the rules of finance and just kind of sitting in a cave by himself sending out smoke signals or something. I mean, it's completely naive and impractical to think that, given all the taxpayer money that we've put into some of these institutions and given the changes in the rules of the game, that he's proposing that he would be doing this in isolation.
Well, let me run another thought by you then, that what you really want in a Treasury Secretary who's trying to overhaul the entire U.S. economy and a good chunk of the global economy as well is a guy who's talking to everybody, and that no matter who calls, you got to pick up the phone.
It's overlooked and perhaps not understood, but for the first 4 months of the administration, he had essentially zero people confirmed. And as a matter of law, even if he's got deputies that are in the wings awaiting confirmation and all of that, they cannot speak externally to anybody on behalf of the Treasury. So I'm sure he took more calls the first few months than even maybe he cared to, because he literally couldn't hand them over to a deputy.
To that point, though, of who he's talking to, the United States government is into Bank of America for $45 billion. But in the first 7 months, according to the AP this morning, Ken Lewis, the CEO of Bank of America, only appears on the Treasury Secretary's call sheet like three times. But he's talking to Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs practically every other day.
Given the trouble that Mr. Lewis was in, maybe he didn't want to be talking to anybody in the government. That doesn't mean that there weren't other people throughout the Treasury and the Federal Reserve that would have been in contact with B of A.
Are you satisfied that Secretary Geithner is getting the advice he ought to have?
Sure. The case for being concerned about something like this would be is that there was this mysterious backroom process, and then all of a sudden up pops a bunch of legislation that seems to come from nowhere. But I think the concern about the Treasury is just that they haven't had the traction to push regulatory reform as far as it needs to go, and that, you know, we're a year past Lehman, and if it were to happen again, he'd have essentially the same toolkit that they had a year ago.
Isn't part of what's raised a lot of questioning about this, though, isn't the fact that Mr. Geithner comes from the New York Federal Reserve? He is, by some, seen as captive to the wishes of Wall Street, and this certainly isn't helping his case any.
I'd like to hear how we could have rewritten the rules for the financial system without consulting the people whose businesses were going to be most effective. I just don't think that's the way Washington does work, and I don't even think it's the way it should work. If he's going to propose something that's going to be dead on arrival because the entire financial services industry is going to pull out all stops to lobby against it, it's in our interest to have him know that ahead of time, or to try and figure out where they can find agreement.
Anil Kashyap teaches economics and finance at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
There was some pushing and shoving at the Detroit Convention Center yesterday. The city was handing out applications for cash assistance to help pay housing and utility bills. There were more takers than there is cash, hence the scuffles. The whole episode is yet another reminder that Detroit is facing some desperate times. But a Michigan farmer has teamed up with a Detroit environmentalist to take advantage of that city's shrinking population. From Detroit, Philip Martin has our story.
To the average eye, Detroit looks like a ruined former automobile capital, dotted by abandoned homes, empty lots, and bare factories. But to Cornelius Williams, Detroit is one gigantic farm, and the evidence is right in front of our eyes, he says, pointing to a table in the middle of this farmer's market on Detroit's east side.
We're looking at beautiful green tomatoes, red onions, white onions, yellow onions.
Cornelius Williams comes from a long line of black farmers from southwest Michigan. He now teaches Detroit residents how to grow fruit and vegetables on vacant lots and to make money from what they grow. The idea came to him during a visit to Detroit a few years ago.
I saw a fella going down the street on a tractor. So being a farmer, I flagged him down and said, man, what do you do with a tractor in the city? He said, well, I make $100,000 mowing weeds on vacant lots. And I got to thinking, man, if we take that money and turn it into growing food on vacant lots.
So Williams got together with a group of local environmentalists who were trying to encourage community gardening. They quickly received funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and created what they called the Grow Collaborative.
Every time there's a vacant house tore down, that's increasing farmland in the city. You know, and so we got to learn how to farm where we live.
And here's how it works. The Grow Collaborative looks for Detroit residents already involved in urban gardening and helps them buy vacant land. Up to 600 farmers have taken over empty lots. About a third of those are in the collaborative. One of the first challenges is dealing with decades of industrial waste that have left considerable amounts of lead in the ground.
That can be a problem, so we grow with what we call raised beds. We create a 4x8 box, and we bring soil in and compost, and so we're not actually growing in the Detroit soil. We're growing in soil that we create ourselves.
The next step, says Williams, was to find a place for Detroit farmers to sell what they grow.
Tonight we met, I knew I...
Live music is part of the scene of the East Warren Avenue Farmers Market, which operates for 16 weekends until the end of October. It generates about $25,000 per season. One of the dozen or so vendors here is 17-year-old Yvette King. She earns about $100 each weekend. She says she uses that money to help her family and sets aside a small amount for college. Not surprisingly, she wants to major in agriculture.
I want to know where my food came from.
And your food is grown where? Where are these beautiful tomatoes and these pears and apples, squash? Where's all this grown?
We have a fenced-in garden that people come by and they look at it and they tell us what a lovely garden that we have.
And everyone is respectful. She says no one ever plucks tomatoes from her garden, even in a city where one of every three residents is unemployed, even in a city that doesn't have a single supermarket within its borders. But surprisingly, that absence of supermarkets has not led to a larger turnout at this farmer's market. Ryan Hertz is the project coordinator for the Grow Collaborative.
The unfortunate fact is, after a few decades of not having access, there aren't a lot of folks who are used to incorporating it into their diets.
Is this another way of saying that you have the fresh vegetables and fruits here, but a lot of people are used to McDonald's?
The lifestyle is a reaction to the conditions of the urban environment.
But it's a problem that Ryan Hertz, Cornelius Williams, and other urban farmers here say they'll keep working at as they focus on turning more of Detroit's abandoned fields into money-making plowshares. At the East Warren Avenue Farmers Market in Detroit, I'm Philip Martin for Marketplace.
Coming up, the dark side of the City of Angels.
Los Angeles is a city which is not commonly known for its organized criminal underworld. But in fact, in no other city did the underworld exercise as much influence in Los Angeles.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 61 points today, 0.6%, closed at 97.86. The NASDAQ gained 13 points, 0.6%, 21.23 at the bell. The S&P 500 climbed 7 points, 0.75%, finished at 1,065. Macy's and Abercrombie and Fitch each put on about 5% today. Kohl's donned roughly 2.5%. Limited Brands stitched up a 4% gain today. Liz Claiborne dressed up more than 30% today. The company is jilting its longtime partner Macy's, moving its namesake brand to JCPenney instead. The price on the 10-year T-note fell. That pulled the yield up to 3.25%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. 7 million K-12 students are enrolled in school districts that use software from SunGard Public Sector. More information at SunGard.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Friday. The Commerce Department releases the August report on international trade. In Washington, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, will hold a demonstration to highlight the effect eating meat has on the environment. And happy birthday to Yale University. The school was founded on October 9, 1701. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is word today that the Senate Finance Committee is going to vote on its health care bill on Tuesday. That is clearly not going to be the end of the health care debate, but to paraphrase Winston Churchill here for a second, it could be the end of the beginning of it. Whatever the final bill does look like, it's going to affect today's doctors quite a bit, and tomorrow's too. As part of our continuing series, The Cure, Remaking Healthcare in America, Joel Rose asked medical students what they think of all the proposals floating around out there.
With her clipboard and long white coat, Manisa Ayala could be auditioning for the cast of Grey's Anatomy as she examines her instructor's scalp in a classroom at Temple University School of Medicine in Philadelphia.
So now I'm going to palpate your skull, apparently.
Ayala is starting her second year of medical school. She plans to go into primary care. She recently talked about her choice with her own doctor. Now he thinks she's the one who should have her head examined.
I've always wanted to go into primary care, and just hearing that from my own physician, don't go into primary care, is really, you know, disheartening.
Primary care doctors earn a lot less than specialists like radiologists and cardiologists. That's a big reason they're in such short supply. The country will need 40,000 new primary care doctors by 2020. President Obama says he'd like to close that income gap. But whether he will is one of many uncertainties about the healthcare overhaul.
You know, we're being asked to make a decision on what we want to do, you know, what kind of career path we want to take without really knowing where it's heading.
Ismar Desderovich is a third-year medical student across town at Thomas Jefferson University. He's wanted to be a doctor since he came to the U.S. with his parents during the Bosnian Civil War.
I'd really like to be able to work with the refugee population myself. But at this point, it's kind of like unrealistic that I'm going to be able to do that.
Unrealistic because Desderovich will graduate with more than $200,000 of student loan debt. So he's training to be an orthopedic surgeon. The White House wants to create more programs that forgive loans for primary care doctors. And the administration would like to boost their Medicare reimbursements. But that boost comes at the expense of specialists. Gary Weissman isn't worried. He's a third-year medical student at Jefferson.
And I think in most other countries that specialists don't make nearly as much as they do in the United States. And so I think it would be a more equitable system. There aren't any poor doctors anywhere.
There's another big question that divides medical students, and that's whether the healthcare overhaul will include a government-run insurance plan, the so-called public option.
It doesn't seem like they're considering much how this reform is going to affect doctors.
Greg Corcoran is a second-year medical student at Jefferson. He's planning to go into a specialty, though he hasn't decided which one. Corcoran opposes the public plan. His reasons may sound familiar.
They're trying to model it after Medicare, but I just think that anything left up to the government is guaranteed to have some inefficiencies.
Corcoran also thinks a public plan would lead to lower salaries for doctors. But there are lots of medical students who support the idea, including Beth Hart, a second-year student at Temple.
Because that's the only chance of real reform happening. Everything else is just tweaking and whatever. It's not reform.
Not all medical students have such strong opinions about the healthcare overhaul. In fact, lots of the ones I talk to have no opinion at all. They're busy enough just trying to make it through school. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
The Los Angeles Philharmonic has a hotshot new music director. Gustavo Dudamel makes his debut performance at Disney Hall tonight. The program includes, aptly enough, a new piece by composer John Adams called City Noir. Los Angeles knows that particular genre pretty well, thanks to great authors like Raymond Chandler and James Ellroy, and some iconic movies like Double Indemnity and Chinatown.
Los Angeles, July 16th, 1938. Dear Keys. I suppose you'll call this a confession when you hear it.
Mr. Gitz, most people never have to face the fact that at the right time and the right place, they're capable of anything.
That's L.A. in novels and on the big screen. But Los Angeles in real life? Author John Bunton says this city was quite a bit different at the turn of the last century.
Los Angeles in 1875 was a dusty little pueblo of 5,000 people. Then, thanks to one of the most inspired marketing campaigns in history, one that touted Southern California as the center of health, wealth, and leisure, Los Angeles started to grow.
The good press was nice. It certainly helped the city's image and its economy. But in his new book, L.A. Noir, John Button says that soon enough, L.A.'s reality became less attractive. Those ads about sunshine and the sweet life didn't just appeal to the good guys. Organized crime came, too. Gangsters eventually controlled politics here and a big chunk of the cash flow. As John Bunton and I walk past the classic 1920s movie houses that line Broadway in downtown Los Angeles, he introduces two of the main characters.
one of the employees of Lowe's State was an 18-year-old kid who had just arrived in Los Angeles from Deadwood, South Dakota. His name was William Henry Parker III. In time, in 1950, he would emerge as the chief of the LAPD, the person who created the Dragnet-era Los Angeles Police Department, and who later became Los Angeles' greatest and most controversial police chief. While Parker was working as a movie usher in Lowe's State, just a few blocks away, another young man was beginning his career, a criminal career. His name was Meyer Harris Cohen. His first violent crime was a holdup of the Columbia movie theater. He got the money with the help of a baseball bat. He got nabbed by the cops, though, because he didn't think about his getaway. He was also 9 years old. And in the decades that followed, Parker and Cohen would emerge as the two adversaries who battled it out for control of Los Angeles.
William Parker, who would later become the police chief. When he got here, what was the relationship between the police and organized crime and the underworld that was helping Los Angeles grow? What was that like?
Well, Parker was young, and it took him a while to catch on to what was happening. In 1927, he joined the LAPD, and as a rookie on probation, quickly made the horrifying discovery that instead of trying to suppress crime, police in Los Angeles actually managed the criminal underworld. His great life calling would be to break the grip of the underworld on police, and to do that, he thought it was also important to free police from the control of politicians.
New York has finances. Chicago had the stockyards and everything else that it built on. Washington has government. Would Los Angeles be Los Angeles? And yes, there's a Hollywood factor here, but would this city be what it is without crime and the underworld and that tension between the police and the bad guys?
Los Angeles is a city which is not commonly known for its organized criminal underworld, but in fact, in no other city did the underworld exercise as much influence in Los Angeles. It really wasn't until the 1950s that control of Los Angeles was finally removed from the underworld.
John Bunton. His book is called L.A. Noir. John, thanks a lot for the tour.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys, ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, not so much news as a commentary on the state of the economic profession, I guess. The Nobel Prize in Economics comes out Monday morning. I obviously have no idea who's going to win, but the markets think they do. The betting line at Ladbrokes in London has Eugene Fama of the University of Chicago as a 2-1 favorite, which is all well and good, except for this. Fama is best known for something called the efficient markets theory, that the markets are, in essence, always right. I would say that's a tough sell after the year and a half we have just had. More to come on this one on Monday, obviously, including perhaps that part where I eat crow. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow gained 61.6%. The NASDAQ up 13 points, also 0.6%. The S&P 500 added 7.75%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, how to make candles for men.
Keep it feminine, because I buy my candles so it smells good for girls, not for me.
Me too. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.